laughing. Neither are the others on board, because they all know Matt Hanley would sacrifice them for a greater good without a moment's hesitation. We all knew it when we signed up for this shit, but that doesn't necessarily mean we want him joking around about it. After a few uncomfortable seconds, I say, "There is an American psychologist who works for the consortium. I know her name, I know where she lives, and I know where she is going to be for the next several days." The speakers are silent for a moment, and then Hanley says, "Let me just get out ahead of you here. Request denied." Dick. "This is not a request, Matt."
"Oh, really? So, what?"
"This is the point where you take down 7 highly trained paramilitaries and an armed flight attendant, all by your lonesome, in the cabin of a mid-sized executive jet, then hijack the aircraft and fly below the radar around the globe until you land on some out-of-the-way American airstrip? FaceTime me while I get the popcorn, because this I've got to see."
"No, Matt, I'm not fighting anybody. You are going to let me do what I need to do."
"And why would I?"
"You may have me in pocket, but you don't have my associate. I've been working with someone else on this, and even if you have her name, you don't know where she is right now. If I don't contact her in 6 hours, I take a quick look at my watch. Sorry, 5 hours and 12 minutes. Then she is going to call your good friend Catherine King at the Washington Post and tell her an amazing tale about how the CIA is propping up a sex trafficker."
"We're not propping him up. We've got the evidence of the relationship. That's all we need."
"Do you think the Post is going to tell your side of it? Or are they going to tell the most sensational version they can?"
Hanley doesn't answer me.
He hates it when I'm right.
I continue, "I don't want to do that, and you know I don't. But I will do it. And you know I will."
Hightower leans over closer to the speakerphone.
"Say the word, Matt, and I'll toss this prick out of the plane without a chute."
But Zack winks at me after saying this, letting me know he's just sucking up to his boss. I'm surrounded by nutjobs. When Hanley doesn't reply, I say, "My associate has banking records tying Dr. Claudia Riesling to the trafficking ring. There is also one of the heads of the consortium, a South African. I saw him. His first name might be Yako, but I can't be certain. He was on the boat that transported a shipment of victims to an auction in Venice, where they were sold off into slavery. My associate knows this, too. Shit, Matt, the Post won't write about anything else for a fucking month."
"What is it you want, son?"
"I want to get off this aircraft in D.C. unmolested. I want to walk away." Hanley hesitates a long time, but that feels promising to me. His hell no's come quickly. His reluctant yeses take a minute. Eventually, he says,
"Approved under conditions. Is that it?"
He knows that's not it.
"No.
I want Hightower, Travers, and 4 more ground branch guys at my disposal for 72 hours.
Hanley laughs now, and I worry I just overplayed my hand. "That request is denied. They're not your men to use, and you certainly can't use them in the States."
He pauses, and I wait him out. Finally, he says,
"But I'll talk to Romantic privately. We might be able to throw you a bone. Again, with conditions."
I'm not sure what he means by this, but it sounds like more than I had hoped for originally.
"What are the conditions?" I ask. "You won't find the director. This guy is as good as anyone on the planet at insulating himself from his operations. That's why he's been informing on international criminals for 10 years, and he's not taking a dirt nap in some gully somewhere. And it's why we don't know who he is. And if you roll up this psychologist or this South African asshole, they won't talk. They know the reach the director has."
"What are the conditions?" I repeat.
"But if I'm wrong, if you do somehow find the director," Hanley says, "then you absolutely cannot kill him, and you cannot have him arrested. He must remain in place. I don't give a shit if you tear down his entire sex trafficking ring, but we need him in play in the international finance world. We need him to be able to operate a computer and deal with the offshore tax havens and criminal elements.
and there can be no comebacks on the agency. He can't think we sent you.
I don't like this, not at all. But I tell myself there is more than one way to skin a cat.
Deal. If I find the director, I will let him live. I won't turn him in, and I won't let him know I spoke with you.
What else?
I need you to be as discreet as possible. I know what you do, and I know how you do it. You can be deep cover, invisible, stealthy like a fucking greased ninja cat. He pauses, then says, and you can also shoot up city blocks on live TV like your Arnold fucking Schwarzenegger. If you are going to operate in the U.S. against an entity you aren't sanctioned to take down, then I need you to be the greased ninja cat and not Rambo. You hear me?
Arnold wasn't Rambo, but I take his meaning.
Agreed.
What else?
What else? Don't die, that's what else. I have work for you.
I bet he does. I say,
I understand and we'll go on all, Matt. Thanks.
He doesn't say you're welcome, no. He says,
Court, one of these days you are going to be more trouble than you're worth.
But not today.
Another long sigh. Not today, no. I need you back here. Do your thing, follow the ROEs I set down, and then get your ass back to work. No more delays, no more excuses, no more rogue do-gooder bullshit.
Understood, sir.
Hanley tells Hightower to take him off the speaker, and then Zack takes the phone to the front bulkhead and sits there, well out of my earshot. I look at everyone sitting around me, and as one, they all relax. I'm no longer their prisoner. I'm no longer a threat. No. Now I have sanction, more or less. I'm back in the game.
43. The Gulfstream aircraft owned by a shell corporation for the consortium had taken off from Venice's Marco Polo Airport over an hour before the CIA flight left Treviso, so it was over 4 hours into its transatlantic crossing now. In the cabin were Cage, Sean Hall, Hall's six men, the two European girls known as Maya and Sophia, Dr. Claudia Riesling, and Jaco Verdoorn. For the first hour of the flight, Verdoorn, Hall, and Cage sat in the back, out of earshot of the rest, and they tried to piece together everything that had happened. Cage was furious at Verdoorn, Hall was furious at Verdoorn, and Verdoorn was furious at his men, especially Lutz, who'd had the fucking gray man in the sights of his SIG pistol and yet failed to shoot him dead. And he was furious at Ryland Jonker for getting his stupid ass shot and killed in a Venice alleyway. Lutz and the seven other surviving White Lion men would be taking a different private jet out of Verona, several hours to the west, because of concerns that the police presence would be significantly ramped up at Marco Polo after the shootout in the city proper. For the second hour of the flight, however, Verdoorn had sat alone up at the front bulkhead, leaning forward and talking into his phone, scrolling through information on a tablet computer on his knees, and taking notes on a pad of paper. Behind him, Claudia Riesling talked to Maya and Sophia nearly constantly, trying to work them harder and harder so that they would accept the fate ahead of them. Sophia was teary-eyed, no longer under the influence of drugs, but Maya was essentially impassive. Riesling saw her look over at Cage from time to time, but otherwise she did not show much reaction to anything said. Riesling knew the young woman was still in a state of shock, but at least she was compliant. She'd be a good pet for Cage, and the director would appreciate his in-house psychologist for it. Kenneth Cage sat next to Sean Hall, who drank vodka on the rocks with a shaky hand. That his bodyguard was shaken up by the events of the evening was not lost on him, but Sean and his boys had done what he paid them to do. He wasn't pissed at Sean. He was pissed at Jaco. Cage himself was into his third scotch and soda when he saw Jaco at the front of the aircraft turn around and ask Claudia to come sit with him. He wondered about this. He couldn't imagine why the severe South African, after losing a man and his target tonight, needed to confer with the psychologist used to reprogram the merchandise. But he didn't think about it for long, because his eyes moved to Maya. As Cage drank down more scotch, he fantasized about grabbing the little Romanian by the hair and dragging her to the sofa in the back, clearing out the bodyguard seated there, and then raping her on the spot, in full view of everyone else. The thought gave him a charge, a sexual thrill intermixed with his rage. He needed someone to take it out on. Who better than the Romanian bitch who'd insulted him and slapped him? He could see the fear in her eyes each and every time she glanced his way, and he loved it. He'd be home in a few hours. He'd have to spend a day or two with his family, and then he'd drive up to Rancho Esmeralda and he'd begin schooling Maya on how to treat him properly. And when he was done with her, he'd have Yako take her back home, his euphemism for disappearing the girls so they couldn't identify him. Dr. Claudia Riesling sat down next to the big man Verdurn and did her best to hide the intimidation she always felt around him. In an attempt to empathize with him and his terrible night, she said, "How are you feeling, Yako?" But he did not answer this question. He said, "I've been making some calls, back to Romania, back to Hungary, back to Belgrade. I'm trying to figure out how the fuck Gentry has been able to stay on our heels like this."
"And you found something?"
"I did." Riesling was confused.
"Well, why are you telling me this? You are the operations and security chief. Sean is the director's lead protection agent. I have nothing to do with.
I did some research on the merchandise on board this aircraft," Riesling said.
"Research? What sort of research?"
"Genealogical research."
"I'm sorry. What the hell are you talking about?"
"It turns out Cage's Romanian prize Maya, seated two rows behind us, has herself a sister.
And?
She's the fucking Europol analyst who went to the police in Dubrovnik 2 days ago."
Riesling sat back in her chair and closed her eyes. When she opened them, she said,
"Why is it you are just now finding out about this?
The recruiters and groomers are supposed to look into the items before they are collected."
"Half-sisters. Different last names. Our Romanian recruiter missed it. The way Cage demanded the bitch be slotted into the next shipment meant they were pressed for time," he added. "Our whore is named Roxana Vaduva, and the Europol bitch is named Talisa Korbu," Riesling said.
"And this Korbu, she's working with the assassin that's been chasing us?"
"Unquestionably."
"But Maya can't possibly know what her sister is doing. She's been strip-searched multiple times. She doesn't have a way to communicate."
"She could know what her sister is doing if she talked to Gentry while on board La Prima Rosa."
Riesling blinked hard at this allegation.
"What?
And then he just beat her up?"
"Was the only way we wouldn't suspect her, wasn't it?"
"But why didn't he take her with him?"
Verdurn looked out the window.
"Either he couldn't pull that off, or she didn't want to go because she's on the job, working for her sister. I don't know which, but either way, she's bloody dangerous."
Riesling looked over her shoulder at Cage, who was openly eyeing Maya right now with a look like a fox staring into a henhouse. She said to Verdurn,
"Why are you telling me? Aren't you going to tell the director?"
Verdurn shook his head.
"It won't change anything. He wants this one back at the ranch, more than I've ever seen him want any of the merchandise in the years I've worked for him. Telling him she poses a threat to him will only create more trouble for us. Not for him, not for her. For us,"
Riesling said.
"I don't really understand your reasoning."
"He'll be pissed we didn't figure out the relationship. He'll be more pissed than he already is that we didn't bag Gentry in Venice or Croatia or Bosnia. And he won't dispose of her until he's done what he wants with her.
So what do we do?"
"I prefer to see this new development as an opportunity."
"To do what?"
Verdurn pointed to his tablet computer. On it was the LinkedIn profile of Talisa Korbu, including contact information and a photo of a waifishly thin, smiling blonde in business attire.
"For me to make contact with my enemy." Verdorn grinned, and Riesling saw it as an especially sinister expression on the man's normally cruel and hard face.
I've caught a couple hours' sleep on the CIA Falcon 50 as we cross the Atlantic, but I wake when my phone begins buzzing in my hand. I look around quickly. It's daylight, and a quick check of the monitor at the front bulkhead tells me we're 40 minutes away from landing at Andrews in D.C. I rub my eyes and snatch up my phone. Talissa, you okay? Her voice is unsure.
I'm okay. I'm at the airport. I'll be in Los Angeles in 12 hours.
I don't want you flying to the...
Harry, listen. Someone called me.
This sounds bad. Who?
He didn't say. He wants to talk to someone called Gentry. Is that your last name, Harry?
And now it sounds worse. I close my eyes and lean my head back. Let me guess. He's South African.
I believe that he is. I can transfer him from my phone to yours.
All right. Do it. I look around the cabin and see that Sharon is up and moving around, but everyone else is still racked out. Men and women in this line of work become experts at grabbing rest whenever and wherever they can. Hightower's head is hanging back off the side of the couch, and he's snoring a snore I spent years listening to, almost every night, when I served under him in the goon squad. I hear a few clicks over the satellite connection, and then a low, gravelly voice starts up in my ear.
Well, hello there, mate.
Hello, Yakko. It was an educated guess, but the hesitation on the other end tips me off that I hit the nail on the head. Finally, he says,
Impressive, bloody impressive. Should have known you'd be doing your due diligence, just like I am.
What do you want?
Two things. One, I wanted to introduce myself, but now I see introductions are unnecessary. And two, I'm just calling to let you know that we've figured out who your informant is.
My informant, I say. But the instant Talissa told me Yakko was on the phone, I knew that he knew about Roxana.
Yes, your informant. The lovely sister of your associate.
I don't speak. I knew it was always possible they could connect these dots, but I hoped they wouldn't. I don't know what this means for Roxana now, but it can't be good.
Don't you worry, Yakko says. We haven't touched a hair on her head. Yet.
I try to help her situation in the only way I can think of. I didn't know who she was when I punched her lights out on the boat. Thought she was just some whore. Cordobu showed me a picture of her after. We thought she was dead. Cordobu's still pissed off I left her there.
You're trying too hard, mate. I know you and Roxana talked after you killed Kostopoulos.
Kostopoulos? Oh, yeah. I only knew him as the old pervert in the bathrobe. But no, I didn't talk to her. Verdorn sniffs out a laugh. I wait to hear whatever his pitch is. He says,
You're good, mate. You know you are good.
And you're bad. You know that too, right?
Guilty as charged. But me and my boys will be around Roxana from here on out, and we can't wait for you to come and try again.
I find this intriguing. So, you aren't warning me to back off. You're hoping I'll keep coming.
That's it. I guess you're used to scaring your enemies so bad they don't put up a fight.
I'm hardly used to that, but far be it for me to dissuade him from thinking I'm a badass. He keeps talking.
Gentry, I'm not like your average bloke. I'm bloody looking forward to the day we meet.
Me too. Why don't you give me your address? I'll pop right over.
No such luck. Can't make it too easy, can I? The boss man wouldn't be happy with me. Nah, mate. I'll just do what I do, work within the confines of my job. I'll let Roxana do what she does, or what she'll be forced to do soon enough, which won't be pretty. I'll just wait for the stars to align and for you to show up in front of me.
Hey, I say, while I've got you, what's it like knowing you are ruining the lives of tens of thousands of innocent girls? How does that make you feel? How does it make you feel killing loads of people? Sharon brings me coffee and I take it,
my hand clutching the phone tightly. Sometimes I feel nothing at all, but sometimes, when it's just the right person, I feel fan-fucking-tastic. And I'm really looking forward to the day I show up in front of you. Yako laughs hard now.
Likewise, mate. You think you scare me, but you don't.
I don't want to scare you. I want your confidence at an all-time high when I drive the blade into your gut. Then you'll get that look of disbelief in your eyes, mixed with fear, mixed with anger. You know the look. You've seen it in your victims, haven't you, Yako? He doesn't reply, and I know I'm in this asshole's head right where I want to be. Yako says,
"You think you're some kind of a hero, don't you, mate? I know your type. I bet you think you're going through all this because you care about the poor, defenseless little whores. But that's not it at all. I can hear it in your voice. You're the same as me. You do all this not because you want to save people, but because you want to kill people. You need to kill people."
He's wrong. Totally wrong. I mean, he has to be. I don't kill because of bloodlust. I kill because of the situations I find myself in. Or put myself in, I guess. Does this motherfucker have a point? Pushing my own motivations out of my mind for now, I say, "Well, it's been a blast catching up. Looking forward to our next encounter. You and me both, mate." I hang up the phone, figuring doing so will piss him off a little. I thought about appealing to him to leave Roxana out of this, but I don't want to do anything more to make him think he has that leverage over me with her. Sharon brings the coffee pot back to refill me, but I haven't taken a sip yet. She says,
"Landing in a half hour."
"Thanks." Zack is awake now, and he moves over next to me. Softly, he says,
"I talked to Matt while you were racked out. We have an idea that might help you a little."
I'm suspicious, despite Hanley's limited sanction. Why is Matt helping me with something he doesn't even want me doing?
Hanley doesn't want you dying for another cause. He wants you dying for him.
It's fucked up, but I know Hanley well enough to know it's true. I say, "Okay, so why are you helping me?"
"Me?"
Zack looks uncomfortable now, weird on the face of a man normally so cocky and self-assured. After a time, he says,
"I have my reasons."
I know his reason, his one reason. "You're thinking about who I'm trying to help, and you're thinking about your own kid, aren't you?"
"My daughter. She lives in Boulder. That's not a guess. I found out last spring. She and her mom are in Witpro. Long story. But I got a guy at the bureau to find out about her."
I know how hard it is to find someone in witness protection, so I recognize the lengths Zack must have gone to. Why did you seek her out after all these years? Now Zack looks almost sick. He isn't the emotional type, so when his eyes glass up and redden, it's awkward as fuck for us both. He says,
"I'm not gonna live forever.
Hell, I might not live till Tuesday." He sniffs back congestion. There are no tears, but he's close. He says,
"Stacy. That's her name. Her mom named her. She probably told her I died in the war or some shit."
After another sniff, he says,
"She's got another dad, a firefighter. I dug into him hard."
After a pause, he says,
"He's a good dude. Saint."
He shakes his head.
"Fucking bastard."
"You want your kid being raised by a good man, don't you?" He nods.
"Of course I do. But I wish I were that good man. I haven't done one thing for her but stay away. That used to be enough for me. But it's not anymore."
Zack clears his head with a hard shake.
"Anyway, these girls in the pipeline, I hope you can help them out."
I'm almost certain the ones I saw in Mostar, with the exception of Liliana, are all but doomed. But maybe there is still hope for Roxana. "What is it you are offering?"
"Wish I could go with you, but Hanley would kick me in the dick meat if I tried. I do know a guy you might want to talk to, though."
"Who?" Zack turns and faces me directly.
Like Hanley said, you've got no problem working with some shady fuckers if it helps you achieve your mission.
That's right, isn't it? I don't hesitate an instant. I'd work with Satan himself to help these victims, Zack.
Hightower nods.
There's a former unit guy. He's talking about Delta Force, and I know them to be among the best shooters on the planet. He transitioned to Ground Branch. He left the agency, started a company a few years back in the Philippines, raiding brothels and rescuing kids being abused by foreign tourists. The sickest of the sick fuckers out there. International agencies hired him and his team after they did the prep work. He and his six teammates kicked the doors, Delta style, went in and took down Johns and traffickers. Zip-tied the perpetrators and left them for the cops, then got the kids out of there and into shelters. This guy saw a lot of action in 3 years of doing this.
I say, he doesn't sound like Satan to me. Still, I don't see how some dude in the Philippines is going to be any help to.
He lives in Vegas now, Hightower continues. His company is defunct.
Almost nonchalantly, he adds.
He and his boys straight up murdered a bunch of dudes.
I cock my head. They did what?
A British national in Manila. They walked in on him raping a little kid. I don't know how little, and I don't want to know. But with all the shit these guys had seen, whatever they saw in that room, they absolutely snapped. My buddy grabbed the British sex tourist by the throat and squeezed. Didn't stop squeezing till he ripped the motherfucker's windpipe out. Dude bled out right there. Filipinos working at the house stormed in unarmed, and the Americans opened fire on every last one of them. 13 dead and all. Damn bloodbath. Right in the center of the Capitol.
That's not Satan's work, I counter. That's God's work.
Yeah, no shit. But the Philippine government didn't agree. Bad for tourism, sex tourism, which they tolerate, but also tourism in general. They arrested the seven Americans, held them in some Manila shithole for 10 months, then extradited them to the U.S. Due to their ties with the agency, they weren't prosecuted here. They were just ordered to keep their heads low and stop doing what they were doing.
But, I say, you think there's a chance they might do what they were doing again, if I just ask?
Zack shrugs. I don't know. Neither does Hanley. But they were good shooters, and you can't second-guess their motivation for 1 second. They lived for this shit before they got popped in Asia and sent home. You tell them what you told me, you might get yourself some backup.
It's worth a shot. Who is this guy, your friend?
Shep Duval. Solid dude, or he was when I knew him anyway.
Upon hearing the name, I close my eyes.
What?
Zack asks. I say, I know that asshole.
Yeah? Well, beggars can't be choosers, Six.
I open my eyes and say,
true, but beggars can be beggars. Any chance I can borrow a gun?
Hightower makes a face of annoyance, but says,
when we land, when we're off the aircraft, I'll get a piece off one of Travers's boys. That's the best I can do.
Thanks, Zack. He nods at me, then gives me a little wink.
Go get him, Six.
44. The girl called Sophia and the girl called Maya were ushered out of the private plane and marched across the tarmac, far from the small terminal and into a waiting black Mercedes G-Class SUV. Dr. Claudia climbed in behind them. From the backseat of the navigator, Roxana saw the director deplane, climb down the stairs, and look her way briefly as he climbed into the back of an identical Mercedes SUV with his bodyguard Sean at his side. Roxana was desperate to find some hint of where she was right now. She didn't know how she could possibly communicate her location to her sister, but it was a moot point until she actually knew it herself. She'd looked around for an airport sign, but she saw nothing. The ocean was on her left as they drove away from the city, and although she'd been no geography whiz in school back in Bucharest, she knew this meant they were heading north if they were in fact on the west coast. There were hills, canyons, and lots of businesses and homes. Then they drove away from much of the development and into more sparsely populated arid hills.
Minutes later, Roxana Vaduva squinted into the sunshine, looking through the windshield of the van as it rolled through the iron-gated entrance of a large ranch. They rumbled up a paved driveway, past a pair of small, squat, stucco buildings, and past four young men. The men eyed the vehicle as it drove by, and she looked through the heavily tinted windows at them, saw the big guns hanging from their chests. The vehicle rolled on. Roxana noted the trees and plants around her, and she realized she had never been anywhere in her life that looked anything like this place. But it felt to her like movies she had seen about Mexico. There was a low rise, and once the G-Wagon crested it, she peered through the front windshield and saw a massive stucco house, the biggest home she'd ever laid eyes on in her life. It was clearly Hispanic architecture, and when they pulled to a stop in front of it, she saw more Latino men in suits standing around carrying guns. She and the Hungarian girl followed Dr. Claudia up the steps and through the massive double-door entrance to the building. Inside, it was cool and dark, and Roxana saw a beautiful young redhead wearing a low-cut evening dress standing there, a glass of champagne in her hand. Roxana was certain it was morning still, and she couldn't fathom why the girl would dress in this manner so early in the day. Claudia led the women up two flights of stairs and down a hallway. As they walked, they passed other girls, all young, some very young, and all dressed exotically in one form or another. None of the girls talked to Roxana or Sofia. Some did greet Claudia, but others just looked away. Roxana was certain that most, if not all, of these girls had been drugged. She could see the distant eyes and slow movement, and she assumed it was more of the Xanax she'd been given sporadically throughout this ordeal. Sofia spoke up as they neared a door at the end of an ornate hall.
Dr. Claudia, how many girls are kept here?
Claudia answered.
No one is kept here. They all want to be here. How many women want to be here?
Sofia asked. At any one time, 20 or so. I don't know what the occupancy is now. They passed a window and Roxana slowed and looked out, again searching in vain for clues as to their location. Soon Claudia led them into a bedroom with an adjoining door to the next bedroom. Maya, you will be in here, and Sofia, just through that door is your room. Roxana found the space to be beautiful, large, and well-appointed with antique furniture. A four-poster bed, a makeup vanity and a chest of drawers, a sitting area, and a massive oak wardrobe accented the room. She followed Sofia into her bedroom and found it similar, but not identical, with a different color scheme. Claudia directed them to their closets, which were full of clothes, including expensive-looking evening gowns, along with more revealing attire. Roxana could see Sofia's eyes light up upon seeing the clothes, upon taking in her new living space. The American psychologist had done a good job brainwashing her, Roxana determined. After the women were settled in, Claudia said someone would be by shortly to take them on a tour of the house. She explained that, although they were not allowed to go outside without permission, the building itself was theirs to roam if they wanted to. Soon the door was closed between Roxana and Sofia's rooms. Roxana and Claudia stood by her new bed, and the Romanian woman could feel the eyes of the American peering into hers, trying desperately, Roxana imagined, to see if her compliance was genuine. Roxana masked her true intentions, of course. She was here to help her sister, just like she'd been from the beginning, although right now she had no idea how to be any use to her at all. There were no phones in the room, she'd passed none walking through the house, and anyway, she didn't know where the fuck she was. Finally, Claudia looked away from Roxana and at her watch as she said, "I have sessions with some other residents. I will be back here to see you each day for the next 5 days. You will have good days and bad. That is to be expected. I want to make sure you are settling in." Roxana was confused.
"You don't stay here at the property?"
Claudia shook her head.
"No, I'm not a part of what happens here.
I am a part of the process that prepares you for it. I do not stay overnight. I will be back, and I will do what I can to help you. Gone was her unbridled optimism about Roxana's time here on the West Coast. Now she seemed more sanguine, less upbeat. Roxana decided to take a chance.
Where are we? What is this place?
Claudia did not answer. She just stared again into the younger woman's eyes for a long time. Eventually, she said,
You should know. Yako is on to you.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, he knows about your sister.
Roxana's heart sank and she lowered onto the bed. She didn't know what this meant for herself or for her sister, but panic welled within her. She tried to play dumb.
What about my sister?
But to this, the psychologist just made a face of disappointment.
You should be proud of yourself for successfully pulling the wool over my eyes for a time. We've never had an infiltrator before, so I didn't properly evaluate you. But now, I see through you.
What is it that you see?
You don't yet accept the fact that your fate is sealed, but you will soon. And as soon as you do, you will realize that your fate is what you make of it. Infiltrator or not, you can have a good time while you are here, if you just let it happen.
Roxana didn't understand this at all, but she was certain this doctor was pure evil, just as bad as the rest of them. She lay back on the bed without another word, and Claudia left the room, shutting the heavy door behind her. 56-year-old Michael Shep Duval slipped his reading glasses off, then put down his Bible. Sitting up from his worn recliner, he looked around the dark living room of his North Las Vegas bungalow. Something was wrong, but he couldn't say what. He scratched at his gray beard, then stood, looked at the little plastic cuckoo clock on the wall, and saw that it was 2200 hours. He hadn't read a clock in anything other than military time since he was 18 years old, and would need a second to realize that civilians would refer to the current time as 10 p.m. The dark house was empty and still. He lived alone, so this was no surprise, but something had alerted him. He was sure of it. He soon pinpointed the source of his disquiet. Where the hell was his dog? Duval's 4-year-old lab monkey had access to the fenced-in front yard facing 2-lane Hickey Avenue by means of a doggy door in the kitchen. She was in and out all evening, every evening. But by this late at night, she could always be found on the threadbare brown love seat next to Duval's reading chair, either sleeping or just looking lovingly at her master, waiting to follow him to the bedroom for the night. But the dog wasn't on the love seat, and she wasn't in the living room or in the little attached kitchen by her water bowl. Monkey, he called out, half expecting the big black dog to shoot through the rubber curtain doggy door from the outside, although it would be rare for her to be out so late. But she did not come. Duval put on the glasses he wore for distance, and he hefted his Wilson Combat 1911 45 caliber pistol off the end table next to him. He was not a tall man, but he was broad-chested and possessed a dominating persona when necessary. He could intimidate now, even in his mid-50s, and even with the paunch that had grown around his midsection since he'd left the agency. And the big stainless steel 45 only added to his intimidation factor. He called for Monkey one more time, then flipped off the light next to his recliner and stepped to his kitchen door. Quietly, he opened it. The business end of the pistol led the way outside. And he carefully walked the chain-link perimeter fence of his tiny property, looking for any sign of his companion. Monkey was nowhere to be found. The rickety driveway gate was closed and locked. Worried, but knowing he needed to check his bedroom and his tiny home office, he headed back into the house. He'd just moved through the kitchen for the back hall, had just slipped the Wilson Combat into his drawstring warm-up pants, when the light he'd flipped off by his recliner snapped back on. Duval didn't scare, and he didn't startle. His body had been through too much to react any way but efficiently when surprised. He turned to the light and saw a man seated there in his reading chair, one leg crossed over the other. The man said,
Leave the hand cannon where it is, and your mitts where I can see them. Duval knew he didn't have a play for his gun. In the seated man's hand was a black Glock 19, wearing a silencer and resting easily on his knee, pointed in Duval's direction. Duval said, "Mister, if you're after money, then this is going to be one hell of a disappointing night for you." To his surprise, the man said, "Take a closer look, Shep." Duval slowly moved a hand to adjust his glasses. After several seconds, he said, "Gentry."
"Yep."
"You're alive?"
"That's a rhetorical question, I guess."
"I'm surprised."
"You and me both," Gentry said. "Sit down. I'm here to talk, but if you go for the gun, we won't have much left to talk about."
"I ain't going for the gun." Duval sat down on the vinyl sofa. "What the hell did you do to my dog?"
"I gave her a steak, 4-ounce filet mignon. Very rare. Raw, as a matter of fact."
Duval cocked his head. "And did that juicy steak happen to be spiked with ketamine?"
"Valium. She's fine."
A pause.
"She's great, as a matter of fact.
Lying in your storeroom by your carport, dreaming of more choice cuts flying over the fence and into her mouth, I'd imagine." Duval nodded now.
"So, this is just a social call? What do you think?"
Duval leaned back on the vinyl, his hands far out to his side.
"I'm gonna guess not."
"Shep Duval is old as dirt, and this disappoints me. He's overweight, and his eyeglasses are so thick they look bulletproof. His hair is thin and gray on his head, and thick and gray on his face. But I know the man, mostly by reputation. And I know that not too terribly long ago, he was a stone-cold skullfucker. As a Delta Master Sergeant, he'd been deployed countless times in the War on Terror, and in the CIA he ran one of the best teams in Ground Branch. I knew of him at the agency after his nearly 2 decades in the unit. He ran another task force when I was on Gulf Sierra with Hightower, and I worked under him once when the goon squad was non-operational when Zack was out with a back injury. I never had a problem with Duval, but that was 7 or 8 years ago. I thought he was old then, and it appears the intervening years have been rough on Shep." He breaks the uncomfortable silence.
"You may not know it, Violator, but I was tasked with killing you a few years ago."
"I did know this, and that is why I think he's an asshole. Still, I say,
you and everybody else."
He snorts out a little laugh.
"Well, it appears I and everybody else failed, because here you are. Is the agency still after you?"
"Sort of," I say. Then, not really. I wrap it up with a little shrug. "It's complicated."
"Right," he replies. Then, "so, other than roofying innocent dogs, what are you doing these days?"
"I'm working, same as ever."
"Private job?"
"Sort of. It's more like humanitarian work."
"I don't follow."
"I need your help." He isn't the type of man to beat around the bush, so I say, "I need you to strap a gun on and to get some friends with guns, and I need you all to come with me."
"To do what?"
"I expect we're gonna stack some bodies before it's all through."
"You're the world's greatest killer or some shit, aren't you?"
I don't answer. He looks around.
"Why me? Why does this feel like a setup?"
He shakes his head.
"Gentry, I got troubles of my own. I want you out of here. Either shoot or scoot. If you aren't going to shoot me, I'm going to pick up my phone. One call to Matthew Hanley and I can have a team of agency shitbirds crashing through the skylights."
I look up at the ceiling of his modest house. There are no skylights, and I am reassured he is speaking metaphorically. I say, "Duval, one call to Matt Hanley will get you a grouchy dude in a bad suit hanging up in your face. Who do you think sent me to you?" Shep thinks this over.
"I'm out. I left 4 years ago."
"I know." He eyes me suspiciously.
"What else do you know?"
"I know about Manila."
"Yeah,"
he said.
"That was a mistake. Not for killing those monsters, but for getting rolled up by the local 5-0 after the fact."
"Yeah," Still, you did the right thing. Fuck you, Gentry, Shep barks. That's my cross to bear, and I don't need you breaking into my house to try to make me feel better. Make your pitch for whatever you want so you can get the fuck out of here and I can scoop my dog up and put her to bed.
Here's my pitch, then. I need some shooters. You and your old team from Manila, if you can get them. Solid guys. Guys who know how to run together.
What for?
To stop a human trafficking ring. He just looks at me in the low light of the tiny ranch-style house. I'm not going to make any sudden moves to the fridge, so you better get us some beers.
I'll let you pull my pistol as you go.
I step up to him, and he stands and turns, his hands away from his body. I disarm him, then walk into the kitchen, keeping him in view, while I pull a couple of cold bottles of Pacifico out of the refrigerator. After popping off the tops, I walk one over to Duval, and we sit back down. Over the next 15 minutes, I tell him about the consortium. My story would blow a lot of people away. The killing, the rape, the kidnapping, the Serbian general and the Greek mobster and the Italian street battle. But not Duval. He's a guy who's seen it all before. He sits there impassively, he doesn't interrupt, and he nods knowingly now and again. And then I finish with the fact that the entire international organization is being run by a man on the West Coast, and we think we've pinpointed a location where trafficked women are being kept. Slowly, Duval's posture changes. This isn't a tale of remote horrors, the likes of which he's heard more times than he can count. No. Now this is about women and girls being brutalized just a few hours away by an animal. And one who is living quite well under the protection of the United States. I can see it in his posture. He's already in.
What's the target location?
He asks, specifically. A 60-acre ranch an hour north of L.A. I assume the victims are held there to be abused, and the people who run the entire worldwide enterprise go there to party. I'm going to crash that fucking party.
The layout of the ranch? Where are the victims kept? Where are the guards and guns?
I don't have that information. From Google Maps, I see one large structure. Smaller outbuildings a half mile away that look like barracks for the security force. If I had a UAV or some more dudes, I could get a better picture. For now, though, it looks like we'll have to just hit it all.
Oppo?
The opposition is unknown. Substantial, I'd be willing to bet. Duval rubs his face hard. I see frustration in his movements.
You've got this operation of yours locked down, don't you, Violator?
He mocks my voice now.
I need you to hook me up with some of your friends to help me go up against I don't know exactly how many of I don't know exactly who in a 60-acre property where friend and foe are positioned I don't know exactly where.
That it? That's about the size of it, yeah, I say. I've got a clock ticking on my ass, too. I do this now, or it doesn't happen.
What kind of clock?
You pick. There's the woman being held there I'm trying to save before anything even worse happens to her. There are the women and girls sold off in Venice that I'd like to recover before it's too late. And then there's Matt Hanley.
What does the DDO want?
He wants me, Shep.
He made a deal with you in exchange for me and a chance to go after the consortium?
You got it. Duval finishes his beer and stands up quickly. I reach for the pistol on my hip, but I don't draw it.
Shep!
He just chuckles, completely unafraid.
You ain't gonna shoot, he says. Who'd shoot a man who's about to bring him another cerveza?
I relax, take my hand away from my waistband. Not me. As the big man walks to the little open kitchen, just steps away, he says,
So, you need men like me and my associates from Manila. Men you know who will lay down their lives for something like this if it comes to that.
That's it. As causes go, you have to admit this is a good one. Duval passes me another Pacifico and takes a swig from his own new bottle.
Okay, Violator. I like it. I don't really like you. I don't like the weak intel. And I don't like the fact that we'll be acting on U.S. soil, but I like it just the same. I've spent the last year thinking about Manila. Not sobbing for the motherfuckers we slayed, but pissed off I couldn't go out and slay some other motherfuckers.
You're in? I ask.
You knew I was in before you got here.
I smile a little. I was cautiously optimistic. What about your mates? You have a six-man team, I'm told. Shep shakes his head.
Did have a six-man team. Scott Camp shot himself in the mouth with a 12-gauge up in Utah a few months ago. His demons got the best of him.
I close my eyes and think of my own demons. I say, the others?
You can pitch it to them like you pitched it to me. Let them decide.
How far away are they?
For an asshole as unlucky as you, you got pretty lucky. We were primarily West Coast-based when we worked in hostage rescue in Asia, and the boys grew roots in that area. One of my guys is in L.A., one's in Bakersfield, another in Lodi, another here in Vegas. I can get them together quickly.
I look at a map of Southern California on my phone. Bakersfield is closest to the target. We'll meet there. He nods and I tip my drink towards him. Then I say, I do need one other thing.
Shit, Violator, what else?
That ranch. I've looked at the sat map. It's a big property, flat, arid, and open. Shep gets it.
They'll see us coming.
I nod. I need a helicopter, flown by someone who can follow orders, and someone who can put skids anywhere I need them, possibly even under fire.
And you think I just happen to know a guy with a helo willing to fly into gunfire?
With a shrug, I say, you've been around a long time, no offense. Hightower said you know everybody. To this, Duval leans his head back on the sofa.
Hightower, what's that son of a bitch up to these days?
I can't tell you. He raises an eyebrow. I just tipped him off that Zack was back with the agency, which is sort of true, but I don't care. I need this guy's compliance, and I'll do whatever I have to do to establish my bona fides.
A pilot and a helo, you don't ask for much, do you?
I smile. You want to pull this op off as much as I do. After a pause, he says,
Zack's right. I know just the guy for you, Violator, and he's right here in town. As good a helo driver as you'll find in the area, and he'd probably pay you for the chance to get some action.
Cocking my head, I ask, what's he doing here in Vegas?
Let's just say he's in the sunset of his career. Like me, I guess.
Great.
But older. A lot older.
Jesus Christ. Shep looks at his watch.
Rack out here tonight. I'll call the boys now. Call the pilot first thing in the morning.
Why not now?
No use. He takes his hearing aids out when he sleeps.
I blow out a long sigh. Of course he does.
45. Talissa Corbu had traveled all over Europe. She'd even been to the Caribbean. But she'd never visited the United States before she deplaned at LAX and went through customs and immigration. Once clear on the other side, she rented a car and drove to a mall where she began buying clothes, a suitcase, and other items she hadn't bothered with in her rush to get on a plane for America. As soon as she was equipped, she called Gentry and he answered on the first ring. When she told him she was in LA, he begged her to sit tight, not to get a hotel room in her name because she was compromised to the enemy, and he promised to call her back with a plan. 30 minutes later, he did so, and he gave her an address in Reseda. When she got there, a woman let her in and put her in a little guest room. Talissa called Gentry back, and he promised to keep her apprised of everything, but if and only if she stayed away from Rancho Esmeralda. She knew where Rancho Esmeralda was, not far away at all. She considered driving there right then, but she did not, because she also knew Roxana's chances were better with Harry than they were with her. She thought it unlikely that her sister would be able to live up to her promise to call her with information on her location, but if her guess was correct about the ranch east of the San Fernando Valley, then they wouldn't need Roxana's help in finding her. She wished she could liaise in some way with the police department here, but her experience told her she needed to stay away from them. Further, Gentry had intimated that he'd learned that the U.S. government had an interest in the operation, and while he didn't think they were actively supporting the sex trafficking ring, he thought it possible, likely even, that they were protecting the director in exchange for intelligence he was providing them. America was just as dirty as the other countries the pipeline ran through. Talissa pushed this depressing fact out of her mind and tried to think optimistically. She sat on her bed in her little room and told herself it wouldn't be long now. She'd see her sister again, and then she'd spend the rest of her life putting things right with her.
This house is a shitbox. I'm in Bakersfield, sitting in a small living room full of car parts, empty beer bottles, and dirty clothes. If the four men sitting across from me now were fresh-faced kids in their early 20s, I would take this for a frat house that lost its house mom. But these aren't kids, not even close. The men are all in their late 40s. Rodney and Stu are white, AJ is Latino, and Kareem is African-American. They all have beards, they all wear glasses, and they all look like they could stand to drop 30 pounds. They're younger and fitter than Duval, true, but that's not saying much. This isn't exactly the A-team. Duval isn't here. He's on his way from Vegas after arranging the Hilo he promised to acquire. But he's called his old team from Southeast Asia and arranged for them to meet me at the home of one of them, and he just texted me to tell me to get started without him. He also hooked me up with a place in L.A. to stash Talissa, at the home of the sister of one of the guys here with me, although I don't even know which one. There are five surviving members of the Manila team in addition to Duval, but one of their number told Shep that due to a recent hip replacement, he'd be more hindrance than help. The four men with me have agreed to nothing. They don't even know the target or the mission, but they are here waiting to hear my spiel. And I take that to be a good sign. Kareem, the African-American, opens the discussion.
We all talk to Papa.
Papa?
Duval. His call sign is Papa.
Makes sense.
He tells us you're legit, your mission is righteous, and it's time-sensitive. But we have some questions.
Fair enough. Shep tells me you four are as good as they come.
Rodney, the homeowner, eyes me suspiciously.
Then that makes me wonder if the shit he said about you was BS too, because we sure as hell ain't exactly at our peak.
AJ, the one I take for Latino, says,
Speak for yourself. I've got my shit squared away.
But the one calling himself Stu replies,
Rodney's right. Shep didn't tell you that.
I've oversold the platitudes. Dumb. Quickly, I backpedal.
Okay, he didn't say that exactly. But he said you guys were solid.
Together you ran missions in the Third World rescuing kids caught up in human trafficking.
And then what did he tell you?
Kareem asks. I heard about Manila. The tension in the room increases a little, but no one blinks. Stu says,
Well, if you did, then you know we've been blackballed by the community. No one is going to send us back out anywhere.
I'll send you out.
It's quiet in the room for several seconds. I register the hopeful looks on the men's faces. Yeah, they want back in the fight just as much as their leader does.
So,
Rodney says,
you are agency?
I'm not going to be able to answer that.
Kareem mutters half under his breath.
He's agency.
AJ turns to him.
How can you tell?
Look at him.
He doesn't look CIA to me.
Exactly. It's a good thing I don't need Kareem for his grasp of logic.
They are still sizing me up, despite the fact that Duval vouched for me. Kareem says,
So you want to lead us into certain death?
Don't be so dramatic. Probable death.
Oh, terrific.
Rodney speaks up now.
Tell us about your target.
It's called Rancho Esmeralda. It's the end of the line of something called the Pipeline, a sex trafficking network that brings women and girls over from Eastern Europe and Asia to serve wealthy men here in the States. Kareem says,
Women and girls? You mean underage girls?
Yeah.
How many?
I don't know how many end up in SoCal, but this is a transcontinental organization that makes billions a year. Rodney speaks with a whisper.
Thousands of victims, then.
I just nod.
Americans do this?
AJ seems surprised, but Rodney notices this and says what I'm thinking.
You don't think we can be just as big pieces of shit as people from other countries?
Stu adds, we can be worse if we put our minds to it. AJ nods slowly now.
Yeah, guess so.
The men look at one another, and AJ says,
if you know women and girls are being abused right here, why don't you just go to the cops?
Because the cops have been tainted everywhere I've been along the smuggling pipeline. I can all but guarantee there are some bad ones here protecting this operation. I hesitate, then say, the guy who runs the whole thing, I don't know his identity, but I have been told he enjoys some federal protection as well.
Shit,
Kareem says.
All four stare at me, and the scrutiny makes me uncomfortable.
Finally, Rodney declares what the others are obviously thinking.
I'm not killing a cop, not even a dirty cop.
AJ adds,
that's right. Doesn't matter how dirty he is. The second he's killed in the line, he turns into Elliot Ness, a hero. White as the driven snow.
That's right, echo the others on the sofa.
I'm not killing a cop either.
This is bullshit, and I feel bad about lying to these guys, but I'm not going into detail about all the dirty cops I've fragged around this planet. They deserved what was coming to them, and my conscience, such as it is clear. I add, but I'll expose a dirty one, and we can bring these guys to justice. Shit, if we do this right, we might really make a difference. AJ stares me down.
I don't know you, bro, but I know your type. Don't start getting too rah-rah there. You're here because you want to hurt people and break shit. That you're doing it for a good cause doesn't change your underlying motivations.
Hurting people and breaking things are both at the top of my to-do list, so there is no sense in arguing with the man. But I'm starting to wonder if either I'm wearing a t-shirt that says Psycho Killer, or if I'm just that transparent to others when I myself don't see it. I let it go. We hear the sound of a car pulling to a stop out front, and all four men produce handguns from under their shirts. Rodney takes a moment to look down at his phone at a text message.
Papa's here.
Shep Duval enters a minute later, along with a man who looks every minute of 75 years old. He's short and wiry, with a patchwork of silver hair and bald spots all over the top of his head, along with a deep-set tan. He moves surprisingly fast for a guy his age, and he steps around the mess in the filthy room and shakes everyone's hands, introducing himself as Carl as he does so. This is going to be our pilot, obviously, and I'm worried that when the other guys here learn that, it will negatively impact the effect of the sales pitch I'm in the middle of delivering. Shep and Carl pull rickety aluminum chairs from the kitchenette and drag them 10 feet to the living room. Sitting down in front of us, Shep says,
Carl will fly us into the target.
AJ says,
in what? A sop with camel?
I fight a smile. Carl, on the other hand, is not.
Screw you, kid. I've got a Eurocopter AS-350 on a ramp at Bakersfield right now, but I can fly anything with wings or rotors, tires, floats, or skids.
Stu looks the man over now.
I'm going to go out on a limb here. You are in Nam.
Carl is obviously the right age. Hell, his skin makes it appear he ate Agent Orange on his breakfast cereal for most of his life.
Damn right. 2 hours flying Huey gunships and transports in Nam and Laos, and then several more years in Air America.
Air America was an airline set up by the CIA in Southeast Asia to deliver men and equipment in support of covert operations. It employed the best pilots in the world in extremely dangerous conditions. Despite Carl's advanced age, the men are impressed now. Kareem says,
Air America? That was some wild shit.
How the fuck would you know?
Kareem shrugs.
Movies, I guess.
You went agency after that?
Rodney asks.
None of your goddamn business, meathead.
Carl looks at the men like they are all children, though not one of them is under 45. AJ says,
that's badass and all, Gramps, but that was then. How long ago did you retire?
The older man shrugs.
I may be retired, but I ain't expired. I can deliver you boys on a dime in a hurricane if that's what it takes.
Shep speaks up now,
looking at his four former teammates across from him.
Carl is solid. Harry is solid. What say you guys?
It's a quiet moment, and then suddenly the man called Stu stands and looks not at me, but instead at his former teammates.
Gentlemen, you know I'd walk through fire with you guys. Shit, we've done it enough times, right? But I got a kid on the way, and I can't end up dead or in some prison. Not even a cushy American one. I'm sorry, but my days of running and gunning are behind me.
The other men stand and shake his hand, slap him on the back, and assure him they understand. Personally, I'm pissed. I need every gun I can get. But I get it. If I had something to live for, I probably wouldn't be slinging myself around like this either. I shake his hand too, and then he leaves without another word. We all sit back down, and I ask a question that I have to ask, although I know I'm going to get reamed for it. Looking at Shep, I say, that going to be a problem? This guy knows our op and he just walks off? Shep Duval shakes his head and the other three men all grumble at me, angry that I'm unaware what an honorable man I had just been in the presence of. I let it go and so do they. Rodney next asks,
when are you wanting to do this thing?
I look to Shep, then say, Duval and I will drive down today, get eyes on the location. We'll get as much intel as possible. We'll come back in the morning and meet here and work up a plan together. Then tomorrow night, say midnight, we hit it. Kareem says,
33 hours from now. You ain't messing around, are you, bro?
Every hour we wait. My voice trails off. AJ says,
yeah, copy that. If we'd hit that flophouse in Manila an hour earlier, who knows?
I still don't want to know what these men saw over there. Rodney stands up.
I'm in. Not like I'm doing anything else. Killing some kid fucker sounds like time well spent.
Both AJ and Kareem nod along to this. Shep says,
okay, Harry. You've got yourself a crew.
Thanks, guys. Shep added,
so you've got a pilot, a small team of shooters, a target, and a timeline. Guess you just need a plan.
And weapons. Did you bring any weapons?
We'll work on the plan together, I say. As for weapons, I was hoping you guys could bring along your own.
This is unprofessional, and the men waste no time in letting me know.
What kind of bullshit op is this?
AJ asks. I heave a sigh. If they thought that was unprofessional, they're about to really flip their lids. And do any of you gents have an extra rifle you can lend me? They bitch. But nobody climbs to their feet to leave the room, so I call that a win. Rodney, the homeowner, finally says,
I've got guns, Harry. You can pick what you want, but only if you promise not to bleed all over them.
I sure promise to try. Rodney's house might be a shitbox, but he has a gun safe in the back room that looks like it cost more than the property itself. It's 6 feet tall and 5 feet wide, and when he opens it, I see something like a dozen long rifles and shotguns, as well as a dozen more pistols and several knives. There are AKs, ARs, an Israeli X-95, and even a big Belgian FN-FAL. He has a pair of sniper rifles. One is a Knights Armament SR-25 semi-automatic, and the other is an old bolt-action Remington 700. Both look useful for tonight's mission, but I grab an AK with an underfolding wire stock. Rodney says,
got crates of ammo in the storage room out back.
You allowed to own this stuff in California? I ask as I adjust the rifle's sling to my frame.
Nope. Not allowed to shoot people either, but I figure that's probably on the agenda tomorrow night.
Good point. I pull a Walther P-22 pistol out of the safe and pick up the .22 caliber silencer lying next to it. Mind if I grab this one too? Rodney looks at me quizzically.
Sure. But I've got other pistols with threaded barrels. You don't need to take that little pea shooter.
I put the Walther and the silencer into my canvas backpack. You never know when you might need to shoot a pea. He looks at me like I'm nuts, then hooks me up with the rest of the gear I need. Seeing the impressive size of his cache, I say, you guys are supposedly retired. Why are you hanging on to so much weaponry? I expect him to say he's just a gun collector or firearms aficionado, but instead he verifies what I have been assuming all along. We're always looking for the next thing we can't stay away from. We're out of the fight after Manila, but we've all wanted to get back into it. Even Stu, until his wife got pregnant. The rest of us? The shit we've seen? Damn, dude. I'm going to be going out hunting traffickers and abusers till I take my last fucking breath. Same goes for the other boys, Papa included.
Works for me, I say,
and then I head out to the driveway to climb into Duval's pickup for the drive down for our recon on Rancho Esmeralda.
46. Shep and I drive south for an hour and a half, most of it through canyon scrubland, finally arriving at our destination at 4 p.m. He parks his F-350 on the gravel side of Lake Hughes Road. We both pull packs out of the bed and begin hiking through the hills. After 30 minutes of this, we crest a rise and then drop to our bellies. We are most of a mile north of Rancho Esmeralda, just south of San Francisquito Canyon Road, and with the maps on our phones and the GPS on Shep's watch, we've picked this particular site as a good overwatch position for our evening of reconnaissance. We pull binoculars for a quick look, then unpack a high-end spotting scope Duval brought along to get a better picture of the property. Spotting scopes suck in the night, but the buildings around Rancho Esmeralda are lit up and the moon is nearly full. These conditions help us this evening, although Shep and I both know they will hinder us tomorrow when we have to try to get as close to that target as possible without being seen. After looking through the optics for just seconds, we realize we are facing a large and formidable property. The 60 power scope Shep brought along helps identify the main guard force to be, as near as we can tell, Mexican or perhaps even Salvadoran gangsters. If experience is any guide, these men will be trained in the use of their weapons but not overly organized as a cohesive fighting force. They are carrying what appear to be civilian AR-15s and shotguns, mostly. And they amble about on foot, drive patrols over the 60 rolling acres in four-wheelers, or sit in covered fixed positions around the property. We don't see any women milling about outside, but that's no surprise. Still, we quickly get an idea about where the victims are being held. The guard force is centralized around the main building, a luxurious three-story ranch house we estimate to be somewhere around 15,000 square feet. While there are other outbuildings around the ranch, sheds and warehouses, and a barn and a couple of cabins, from the disposition of external security, we determine that the girls are located in the big house. The bunkhouses are to the east on the far edge of the property, but there are vehicles parked behind them and a halfway decent road through the undulating landscape to the big stucco house, a half mile to the west. Just after 9 p.m., a pair of high-end SUVs turn off the main road, roll up the drive, and stop at a guard position. A minute later, they continue forward until they finally stop again in front of the main house. The drivers open the rear doors in both vehicles, and four men climb out and head up the steps to the front door. They disappear inside a moment later. Shep says what I'm thinking.
Johns.
Yeah. If I had a sniper rifle on me, I'd be inclined to open up on these bastards, so it's a good thing I don't. I speak softly, knowing how voices can travel on a quiet night. We'll do a helo infiltration, concentrate forces on the main building. We secure hostages, and then, hopefully, fight our way back out.
Hopefully, Shep mutters.
Yeah, I know. Hope isn't a strategy. But tomorrow night, it will definitely have to serve as a tactic. Shep nods.
We need two outside to keep the responding forces occupied. I'm old. My knees are pretty shot, but I can snipe. I'll fly shotgun in the helo and provide air cover. Me and Carl will circle the target during the raid. And AJ can knock the stink off a gnat's ass from 1,000 yards. We'll put him on that hillock over there on the other side of the canyon. He'll do his best to keep the guys in the bunkhouse busy.
I laugh in the dark. We make it sound so easy.
Shep spits into the dirt in front of him.
Getting in, not easy, but doable. Getting out, I don't know.
One problem at a time,
I say. Then I ask, you're sure Carl can handle this? Without hesitation, he says, he'll be fine. You met him at the agency?
Nah, he's been retired since, like, forever. He flies that helo at a 250-acre gun range north of Las Vegas. Weekend warriors go there to shoot targets from the air, and he gives them the ride of their lives.
He knows he's gonna get shot at tomorrow, right? Duval nods.
He knows the mission. Look, you've got 5 guys willing to face death to help save those girls and frag any of those fuckers holding them who try to stop us. Don't look too deep into the motivations of any one of us, and we'll try not to think too hard about yours.
Fair enough. Have you seen his helo?
Sure. Decent little 4-seater.
I take my eye out of the scope and look at Shep. A 4-seater?
Yep.
Confused, I point out the obvious. You, me, Rodney, Kareem, and AJ, plus the pilot, that's 5.
Doesn't matter.
Why doesn't it matter?
Because you, AJ, Kareem, and Rodney are riding the skids.
Shit, I think. What have I gotten myself into? Says who? Shep shrugs.
Carl in the right seat, me in the left, you guys outboard. When we're about 1.5 clicks out, Carl will drop AJ off. He'll set up a sniper position, and the rest of us continue on to the target. You can get off those skids faster than you can get out of the cabin of the helo, and the insertion has to be fast and smooth for us to be able to pull this off.
He's right. But now I add falling off the side of a helicopter to my death to my long list of things to worry about. And with that, we settle in for another hour or two of recon before returning to Bakersfield. Ken Cage worked in his home office all morning, beginning at 7, well before his normal start time of 9. Heather was annoyed, but she read his mood and didn't push things. She only peeked in once to see if he needed more coffee, and the kids didn't come in at all. But by 10 a.m., Cage realized that he couldn't stay on task today. No, there was too much on his mind. He didn't know how close he'd come to getting killed the night before last, certainly closer than he'd ever been in his life. White Lion had never had a serious injury in the 5 years they had been protecting and overseeing the pipeline, but now they had a man dead. Sean Hall was scared. Kostopoulos was dead. The way station in Bosnia had been closed, and the Serbians, the Albanians, the Greeks, and the Italians were all freaking out about this new danger to the consortium. Verdun and Hall were both here at the Hollywood Hills mansion today. Hall was outside the office in the living room, working in his close protection role, his 6 men patrolling the grounds. Verdun was camped in a guest room on the 3rd floor, using it as a residence and as an office. His men, the 8 of them still alive, were up at Rancho Esmeralda, although Cage didn't exactly know why. In all the years he'd run the consortium, Cage had never felt himself on shakier ground.
He knew he had to be the leader now. He had to show strength. And for this reason, he called in Hall and Verdun for a conference in his home office.
The billionaire financier turned up the ambient sound, had Hall lock the door, and then the 3 men sat together in chairs in front of Cage's desk. Cage looked to the South African first.
Any danger your dead guy in Italy is going to get traced back to you?
None. All my men have their own offshore corp set up. There's nothing to trace them to White Lion, any other corporations involved in the consortium, or you. Cage next turned to Hall.
I'm going to Esmeralda tonight. That going to be a problem?
Sean Hall looked to Verdun, then back to his boss. He was obviously less sure of himself than Yako.
We have no intelligence that says Gentry is in America, or that he even knows your identity, but he's managed to show up at location after location along the pipeline. I know we're in America, and that may mean he's less likely to present himself, but still, I think it would be best if you laid low for a couple of weeks, just until Yako and his men get this situation handled.
The South African spoke up immediately.
I disagree. As Hall said, we've got nothing to say he's here. He's coming here, or he even knows about here.
Cage replied coolly.
You said that in Italy. How did that work out?
To this, Verdun shrugged. Look how bloody close we got to the prick.
How should I know how close you got? Cage snapped.
Sean and his boys had to rescue me before the gray man got within striking distance.
Verdorn's eyes narrowed, but only for an instant.
We were close, sir. We've got feelers out for him here, too. If he arrives, we'll know, and we'll put a stop to him. I've got my men at Rancho Esmeralda supporting the guard force there. We'll get him this time. Should he come? You've said yourself a dozen times there is nothing in the